Today on Vox Talks Economics, what economists can tell us about history in 100 seminars. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, subscribe, follow us on Instagram as well. You find us at Vox Talks Economics. In October this year, the International Macroeconomic History Online Seminar Series, which is jointly organised by the Graduate Institute Centre for Finance and Development and the Centre for Economic Policy Research and a consortium of universities and institutions from around the world, will present its 100th seminar. And so in a special episode today, we have asked the organisers of the series, that's Nathan Sussman and Rui Esteves, both of the Graduate Institute and CEPR, of course, to choose three of their favourite episodes each and to tell me why they like them. Nathan, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hi, Tim.
And Rui as well.
Hi, Tim.
For anyone who hasn't watched any of these seminars, where have you been if you haven't been watching them? What are they?
Superficially, they're similar to seminars, right, that you would attend in a university or any other context, central bank. The difference is that we made them available online and they're also hosted online. So we have people from all over the world literally attending every single seminar and they can interact with the speakers and so on.
Yeah, another fun feature of these webinars that I like is the fact that we give the speaker 40 minutes uninterrupted, which is sufficient time to get almost anything across. Then we have a Q&A, but also in the last 15 minutes, a more informal chat mimicking a real life situation where sort of it's not that formal. And we get to talk more with the speaker and interested listeners, viewers can actually stay on and engage with the speaker. And for many, many people who are doing economic history, it's a relatively small field. And in many universities around the world, they don't have economic history departments or dedicated economic history seminars. And this is an opportunity also to interact with colleagues with likewise interests globally, which I think is a great feature.
Whose idea was it to start this?
I don't know. which one?
Actually, remember. Let's say it was a joint idea.
When you started this series, though, did you think it would go for 100 episodes? That's a lot.
Not really.
No.
Well, at first, I don't think people expected COVID to last that long. And all the restrictions to last that long.
Because this is when it started, isn't it? Yeah. About 2021, yeah.
Just when COVID started, when the lockdowns began and we had to move from in-person seminars to online. And as Rui said, it's not just this seminar. Many seminars popped out during this period. But I think with a very few exceptions, this is one that survived post-COVID and is still alive and kicking in its 100th episode.
I think there's two reasons for that. So one already alluded to by Nathan is that this is different in the sense that we're not all in the same physical location, which limits the audience. So we're really open to the world, which is a great advantage for people working in smaller universities that don't have access to the usual seminar circle. But it's also a great advantage for the presenters, right? Which just one video can broadcast their research to the whole world. We also archive every single recording and every single webinar on YouTube. So you don't also have to be there on that specific time. If you can't, you can always listen to the recording afterwards.
Now, I gave you the task of picking three out of these almost 100 now episodes each. When you look at the list of who's given a seminar, it really is a who's who in economic history. So was this a difficult job to do, Rui?
Yeah, there were many more, right? We don't have time to talk about all the ones I wanted to highlight. Yeah. And so I just had to use some kind of objective rule, which was to check the webinars that had greater attendance at the time and since. So the ones with a bigger footprint, if you want. And from those, there were many at the top, you know, very hard.
Nathan, how did you choose yours?
Using a similar method. In my case, I chose the ones that I also moderated. And I think we should add to one of the nice features of the seminar, which is also different from many of the other online seminars and the ones that are still running, is that we share the moderation. So in the first year, I think Rui and I, or the first semester, we did all the moderating. But then every episode, we have a different moderator. So this increases the number of people who participate in this event actively. And we also try to be very inclusive in terms of choosing our moderators and giving them an opportunity to interact with their colleagues as moderators. So this introduces also a different flavor to the series. And it's really nice to see that people collaborate and also not just presenting their work, which is obvious, but also agreeing willingly and happily to moderate the papers. And some of the moderators are actually people who the presenter has an academic discourse with and sometimes disputes, and it could be really fun.
I would like to make the point that the 94 that we're not going to mention today are also terrific, and I would really recommend that after listening to this podcast, that you go and check many of them out. The reason we've chosen three, well, we don't have a long enough podcast to talk about all of them. So we'll talk about your choices in a second.
There are many Vox Talks that show us how historical events have never been more relevant. Here are two. From September 2023, Kevin O'Rourke asked, should history change the way we think about populism? And in April 2024, Felipe Valencia Caicedo and Anna Torprats discussed the century-long legacy of distrust from what they called the long shadow of the Spanish Civil War. Follow us to find these and many, many more episodes like them.
So, Rui, what's the first of the seminars that you chose?
So, I'm going to talk about a webinar from September 2021 on the Smoot-Hawley trade war. The presenter, Kirsten Van Schneider, presented joint work with Chris Michener and Kevin O'Rourke that goes back to one of the most famous historical tariff rises during the Great Depression.
So, let's hear a clip from that.
The Smoot-Hawley Tariff Bill of 1930 has often been cited as a cautionary tale of a trade war. It's been associated with a disastrous decline in trade in the 1930s. It's often seen as a contributor to the severity of the Great Depression, and by some, among them Harold James, the end of globalization.
So this was motivated by the aggressive tariff policies of the first Trump administration. I don't know if you remember this famous tweet from March 2018, where Trump said that trade wars were good and easy to win because no country yes. would dare to retaliate against the U.S. economic clout.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting of both of those Trump administrations is the historical references that they make. And so one of the big ones is this Smoot-Hawley tariff of 1931. What the authors show is that this tariff generated significant trade wars, lots of retaliation, which then led to significant economic costs to the US and to the rest of the world, right? So there's obvious parallels to the then still muted trade war between China and the US and a much more outward and indiscriminate tariff aggression of the second Trump administration. So history doesn't repeat. That was not the point of this webinar, but help us conceptualize what would be the likely nature of the reactions to the Trump moves on the first two tariff waves and the likely size of the costs.
It was very relevant then, as I remember we were doing a lot of episodes about that. It is even more arguably relevant now. Nathan, what would you pick as your first choice?
From the three choices that I have, two of them chronologically, because they're kind of in the same vein, and then the third one, which is in the middle chronologically, but is on a different topic. An interesting feature of economic history is that we get insights from historical episodes that can really inform us. Of course, history, as Rui said, never repeats itself, but it provides great insights and way to think about episodes a little bit outside of the box or enlarging the box in terms of putting in some additional evidence to bear on these issues. So with that in mind, I think one of the very interesting podcasts we had was the one by Charles Goodhart and Pradhan on the demographic reversal, aging society and waning inequality and the inflation revival.
Let's hear the distinctive voice of Charles Goodhart.
So for all these reasons, we think that the world is likely to become more inflationary and perhaps even in the next few years. But our concerns about this are not shared by the great majority, the mainstream of economists, though the conversation and discussion is beginning to turn.
It was in February 21, we were emerging slowly out of COVID. And there was a big dilemma after almost a decade or more of zero inflation, negative inflation. Everybody said inflation was dead. It's all gone. And they had all these structural explanations as to why inflation is dead. Suddenly, it reappeared. Charles, with his very impressive long career, both in policy and academics on monetary issues, with his co-author, tried to identify key structural elements that would make the inflation that we saw in COVID persist forward. And so they talked about changing demographics in the sense that before COVID or in the previous couple of decades, there was an increase in labor supply, mainly out of China, and that lowered wages and that made lowered prices and made everything cheap. And COVID, of course, disrupted all these supply chains. And once you have reshoring, a little bit more manufacturing in the importing economies, then they're facing this aging issue and labor scarcities. And therefore, through wages and some kind of a wage, persistent wage inflation, we would still have this impact on inflation. There was a lot of debate because back then, you know, some people stuck to the, you know, we had this low inflation, it's never going to pick up. And what he was saying was at the time a little bit controversial. And he was also warning, in some sense, central bankers not to be complacent about inflation, not to look through it. And now, speaking almost 5 years after the fact, they were right. Inflation became more persistent and it didn't go down even after 5 years to zero negative. People say that central banks were indeed complacent and did not act fast enough. So from my perspective, it was not only an interesting discussion during the seminar, but also demonstrates how looking back at history, not just focusing on the short term, because people look back 10 years and say, oh, there's no inflation, it's gone. But he showed 200 years of history, how inflation goes up and down and up and down. There's no reason to think that the experience of the last 10 years is what's going to determine the future.
A great choice, Nathan. Rui, what was your second choice?
Second choice takes us to March 2023 and the power of financial sanctions. So the context follows very quickly on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and all the debate focused then on what's economic power and whether it can be deployed to achieve political objectives. This was not exactly a debate started by the war, but our minds were focused because of it. The speaker on this occasion was Barry Eichengreen from UC Berkeley, who presented research from a couple of papers on the historical evidence to try and answer two questions. So one short term, which is whether sanctions are effective. And the second, looking to the longer run, is what are their consequences, and in particular for the international financial architecture, and especially the role of the US dollar as a reserve currency.
We have a clip of that as well.
So that's the sense in which these recent sanctions are unprecedented, and potentially, it is argued by some, a game changer with implications for dollar dominance, exchange rates, and the form in which central banks hold their reserves.
Many people were surprised after the war that the Russian ruble recovered so quickly after the initial dive, indeed after the war. But actually, Eichengreen shows that this has been the historical norm, also in past cases of financial sanctions imposed in the context of military disputes. And the answer is actually deceptively simple, but someone had to stated it. And it goes as follows. So sanctions harm especially the ability of the sanction to import. They harm their exports, but especially their imports. And if these are combined with attempts to block their access to the financial markets, which of course prevents them from borrowing, this leads to a situation where the balance of payments effectively almost goes back to early modern times, where the balance of payments was the balance of trade. So you cannot finance any trade deficit, you cannot import. So unsurprisingly, if you can't import, your currency cannot depreciate. Actually, it appreciates, but that's not a sign of resilience, it's quite the contrary. And in terms of long-term implications, Eichengreen drew on work by his co-authors and longer-term work has been done on the role of the US dollar. Here, he found, consistent with his previous work, that sanctions haven't really drawn an escape from the dollar by other nations. Possibly because the main reason is that there's no clear alternative. So the status of reserve currency has a considerable inertia. Perhaps the most obvious alternatives haven't risen to the task. It's well known that the euro has underperformed its lofty expectations of their creators back from the 1990s. The renminbi as well has been trouble growing into a viable alternative because of questions of governance, technology, and so on. He also spoke about the possibility of cryptocurrencies, in particular the central bank version, trying to make the room for it, but it hasn't happened yet. And the only significant evidence he found from history is that after each episode of this financial section, especially the ones levered by the US, the only reserve asset that gains is gold. But before people get excited about this, the effect is very small. It's significant, but very, very, very small. I said earlier that history doesn't repeat. History is also not necessarily a guide for the future. This is not to say that the US dollar will just keep on ruling the financial waves and that we will not eventually have to cede its position to some alternative international asset, namely because the historical cases of shifts in reserve currency status did not happen incrementally. They happened in one bang, in one go, and it's unclear whether we're just before one of those or not.
We have a news horizon. We can measure in hours. I think it's the role of economic history to be able to give us a longer perspective. That's a great example of that. Nathan, your second choice.
My second choice, and which is somewhat following my first choice, is the webinar by Alan Blinder from September 24, summarizing his book on monetary and fiscal history of the United States from 1961 to 21.
Here's a clip of that one.
There are two tools to fight aggregate demand excesses or aggregate demand weaknesses used in opposite directions, monetary policy and fiscal policy. So if you didn't know anything about American economic history, a naive view might be that, well, there's a left arm and a right arm and they work together. And depending on what has to be done, they're both expansionary or they're both contractionary. As I said, that would be a very naive and incorrect view.
First of all, it was extremely interesting to see the follow-up on Friedman and Schwartz, which is the classic book on the monetary history of the United States. But it's also coming from a person who's a distinguished academic, was a vice chairman of the Fed for a couple of years, but also on the Council of Economic Advisor of the President. So he could see fiscal and monetary policy firsthand, but also has the scholarly perspective on these issues. And so he walked us through the three central questions of this monetary versus fiscal. And the first one he focused on was whether monetary or fiscal policy was used to stabilize the U.S. economy. And over this 20-year horizon, he documents a gradual shift from using fiscal policy, which was used by Nixon and Ford and Reagan, and then the monetary policy picking up the space and basically becoming the responsibility of the Fed to do the cyclical policies. Then he talked about the attitude of the administrations towards government deficits, this shift from thinking that deficits are really bad or something that president should really care about, which is in the first 15 years. And then there is this gradual loosening of the reins on fiscal policy, maybe partly due to the fact that we wouldn't worry because we have the monetary policy, inflation is under control. And finally, which I think is really relevant, all the three are really relevant to the debates we have today. And I think at the time that the seminar was presented, it predated the debate that we see now in the US about central bank independence. The earlier presidents in the 60s, going all the way to the mid 90s, the central bank was not independent. And the president had some leeway in terms of coercing the Fed to do things that are in line with their policies. But then gradually, central bank independence emerged and it was solidified by Bernanke and Yellen and Powell. And now we have this activities by Trump, sort of the attempt to undermine central bank independence, which are really interesting. Again, looking at history, central bank independence was not a constant in US history. And the position of the Fed is something that evolved gradually. It's not some legal mandate or some kind of God-given powers. It's something that evolved gradually where administrations actually were willing to give the central bank power in order to smooth or deal with a business cycle, but also they delivered on inflation for the most part. And these things are now, of course, being challenged. Central bank independence in the United States should not be taken for granted because it wasn't always the case. And therefore, this puts things in perspective looking forward. And it makes you think about what are the forces that actually determine the balance of power between fiscal and monetary policy in the US.
Something that we're all discussing and a reminder of the consequences of actions or inaction on these things. Thank you. Rui, your final choice.
My final choice is a different type of webinar. Once in a while, we also try and stop the program to have a debate about important research agendas. And so I'm speaking about a webinar from the last series. This is from April 2025, which was a panel around the topic of industrial policy in history. Of course, industrial policy, state capitalism, whatever you want to call it, is a big topic again. And we wanted to try and gather three of the best and most reputed specialists on the topic the historical topic, and those are Giovanni Federico from NYU Abu Dhabi, Rekha Jayaraj from the University of British Columbia, and Kevin O'Rourke from Sciences Po, to give us perspective on what history can contribute to this topic.
We have a clip of Kevin O'Rourke.
Industrial policy is the rule rather than the exception. If you look historically, it's, you know, the period from 1990 maybe to 2020 or something maybe didn't have an awful lot of industrial policy knocking around, but that's kind of weird because there usually is a fair bit of it around the place. And, you know, by industrial policy, you know, there's various ways of promoting innovation, attracting technical expertise, you know, public financing research, attracting FDI, government procurement policy is very important sometimes, construction of railroads going further back in time, educational policies, and I would say also tariffs.
It was a different type of seminar, but it was an extremely interesting discussion. Both the contributions from the three speakers and the discussion afterwards was especially insightful. And I gather that it got many people trying to adapt their research agenda to this important topic. I'm not going to try and summarize the contributions of each of them. Let me just say that the key reason why we chose this is that industrial policy has been a fixture of history for a very long time. The more recent moves of large emerging nations and large advanced nations towards more interventionist state capitalism appeared to come against the grain of things, so this unstoppable growing trend towards economic liberalism. And actually what all three of our speakers in this webinar agreed is that that period of economic liberalism was the exception, not the benchmark. That's point one. And point two is that it's frequently associated with economic success. So one of the speakers asked rhetorically, which advanced economy today hasn't become rich without using industrial policy, right? And the answer is there, none. Okay, but this is not a guide for development either, because many other nations attempted exactly the same strategy, namely through industrialization, through substitution of imports, and for other types of industrial policy, but achieved no similar results, right? So up and down Latin America, in Africa, many of these experiments of industrial policy didn't went well. So it's unclear what's the connection between development and industrial policy. There's also abundant historical evidence that frequently the objectives of these industrialization policies were not purely economic. They were also political and strategic. Tariffs and industrial policy have always been frequently connected to international tension and geopolitics. This is pretty obvious if you go back to the 17th century and the wave of mercantilism, where the two things are definitely connected. So a competition for political supremacy and a competition for economic success, they were definitely connected. No policymaker at the time thought of them as separate things. And this has carried on all the way to today. And then there was also debate whether what do we know about the effectiveness of these policies, tariff-based or not. And there, the evidence is all over the place. History is not a safe guide to any kind of industrial policy today. You can't just go back in history and say, see, history proves me right. Because exactly the same policies in different contexts and different periods either were successful or were outright failure. So we definitely need to learn more. And this is where, in the end, we ended up in a nice agreement that there's an historical agenda that is dying to be developed, which is to bring back the state into the history of the Industrial Revolution and move away from perhaps romanticized ideas of laissez-faire capitalism as the way to go, because, again, those are the exceptions, and they're probably not a correct representation of history either.
Nathan, your final selection.
So once in a while, we also have some webinars that do some deep dive into big historical questions. So one of them that I particularly liked, and I think is still relevant, which is one of the features of all these topics and all these webinars we talked about today and many others in the series, that is, Tim, as you mentioned, it's worthwhile going back to these because they don't fade with time. Actually, actually, when you go back and look at them and say, gee, I mean, they saw something and there's something which is still relevant today. One of these, which the one by Odette Galore from Brown University on the general humanity, which is a big sweep of history trying to explain comparative development of nations.
Let's hear a little bit from that one.
The Journey of Humanity explores the evolution of societies since the emergence of Homo sapiens nearly 300,000 years ago in Africa. It focuses on two of the most fundamental mysteries in the context of the human journey. The mystery of growth namely, what are the roots of the dramatic transformation in living standards in the past two centuries after hundreds of thousands of years of stagnation? And the mystery of inequality, namely, what is the origin of the vast inequality in the wealth of nations?
His main argument, which on the face of it is very controversial, relates to the fact that there are differences in genetic diversity between people living around the world. And there's a simple diversity model where mankind emerged mainly from Africa, and that's where human beings were prevalent, and therefore they had a large genetic pool. And the further away you go from Africa, the genetic pool diminishes, and he correlates that with comparative development. The model that he has in mind is that when we have a lot of genetic diversity, we have lots of ideas because many people have different ideas. There's a lot of diversity. On the other hand, it's very difficult to collaborate and cooperate because of this diversity. Think about the Tower of Babel, for instance, as an analogy for this. And as the further you go away, the easier it is to collaborate and to conform, but then maybe we don't have as many ideas. And as usually in economics, there's between the two extremes, there's some kind of an optimum of diversity, which has the right mix of diversity and cooperation. And those countries are historically more successful. So leaving it that would be, and I think this is part of the journey of the author, not just of humanity, from a paper that basically says, you know, this is pretty deterministic to what we can do about this. And I think that's the second part of the webinar, which I think I really liked. And when I go back to is the fact that it's not enough to follow the policies of the major organizations about institutional reform, about human capital, education. It's not just about that. It's about what kind of education we should have. In areas where we have a lot of diversity, we should talk about tolerance and respect to other ideas. And in areas where we have less diversity, we should promote the diversity. And so it's not one size fit all, and not just STEM as sort of the best educational policy for growth and development, but also we should really worry about the kind of education we provide our children if we want a sustainable growth and development in this world. And I think that's a very interesting conclusion, which resonates very well in the sense that we see the effect of polarization and disrespect for the other, mainly in the quote-unquote successful economies, which is the ones that performed very well in terms of, but they had a lot of diversity, a lot of ideas, a lot of creativity. But at some point, the educational system or society left these important social type of education behind. And I think that's still really relevant. If we want to move forward in achieving development and growth, then it's not just enough to look at, again, the usual suspects that now are very popular in economics, like institutions and human capital, or even health. It's also what kind of education, what kind of values do we promote in society to make this thing sustainable? So I think the webinar was kind of a really big intellectual journey, but also with very concrete, in the end, policy recommendations that 4 years after the fact, when I revisited the webinar, said, gee, this is the really important thing. And how come all of us are missing that in some sense?
A really big topic to finish our selection. Thank you very much, both of you. You've done 100 episodes now. Are you going to run out of things to talk about?
I'm sure we won't. I was just looking at the program for this series, and we have a very wide spread of topics from central bank independence to tariffs and growth to geoeconomics. There's not a fixed stock of topics because the ingenuity of our colleagues and the profession just keep on pushing us forward.
Yeah, the other element of the series that makes me confident that we're not going to run out of ideas is, of course, we don't select them ourselves, Rue and I. We have a dedicated board of colleagues from the international partners that we have that help us in the selection process. So we have a lot of diversity of opinions in the selection process. So that's an interesting feature that keeps the series alive. We oversubscribe. So usually we have a couple from the previous semester that we push on to the following semester because we ran out of slots. And the other thing is also that we give the floor to PhD students, young researchers that don't really get this exposure on a daily basis. And the young minds keep coming with great ideas all the time. Yeah, if we were just doing, you know, a superstar series, we would run out of ideas or topics after 100 sessions. But of course, we tap all the creativity and the passion of young researchers, and those keep coming along, and they have this global stage to present their ideas.
Can you pick one topic that you would like to see in the second 100, Rui?
I don't want to set the agenda. I think I would rather be surprised by the ingenuity and by the relevance of research in economic history.
It's really the creativity of the scholars that present the material. We go to a seminar to hear new things, to learn new things. I think that's what makes it interesting for both of us to keep this going on. It's not just a service or a job we do for the profession, which is really important, but also satisfying our own personal curiosity and desire to learn surprises.
I'm certainly hoping that we have another 100 of these. Thank you very much for talking about them today. Thank you, Rui.
Thank you.
And Nathan.
Thank you, Tim.
You can find these seminars at cepr.org. If you go there and search for them, they are very easy to find. I would recommend that you watch all of them. Probably not all at once.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, are newspapers influencing us with their choice of pictures?